We're going to conclude our series today on rites, rituals, and religion by coming to terms with whether or not the Jewish religion was established by God or by someone else, perhaps Moses and Aaron. Today we'll look at the example of sacrifices to understand whether or not this vital practice in the religion of Israel and Judah was borrowed from neighboring heathen tribes or something designed and instituted by God. The word sacrifice comes from two Latin words, sacri, meaning sacred or holy, and facere, which means to make. So a sacrifice is simply the act of making something holy which was not otherwise holy. It is the surrender of something valuable but ordinary, for example, the blood of animals, as a means of gaining something more desirable. The unholy blood in this case is transformed into something that is holy and acceptable to God. So sacrifices are good, right? The Bible contains lots of instructions about how and when and where to sacrifice. Killing helpless, innocent animals, not primarily for their meat, but for their blood, sounds like an idea that God would come up with, right? If God wanted to accept his people, or to have them commit to a covenant, or to forgive sins, he could certainly come up with any means imaginable, anything he wanted. Why would we assume that something had to be slaughtered in order for God's anger to be quenched or satisfied? And let's not forget that every contemporary heathen polytheistic religion around the world had the same idea, that animal or human blood was necessary to appease the wrath of the gods or to make payment for human transgression. What if it was Moses and Aaron, or someone else, influenced by the heathen superstitious religions around them? What if it was they who designated and designed and instituted sacrifices? What if the God who would naturally love all his creation, all of it, including the animals, did not design sacrifices for Israel? Well, you may not like the question, and if you don't like the question, then you really won't like the answer, because the Bible actually seems to very strongly suggest exactly that. Let's begin with Psalm 40, verse 6. Sacrifice and offerings you, God, did not desire. But my ears you have opened, so that I may hear what you're actually saying. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. The psalmist isn't saying that God didn't like a particular type of sacrifice, or that they were doing it wrong or from a wrong heart or motive. He simply states that God did not ask for sacrifices. Psalm 51, verse 16 to 17. For you will not delight in sacrifice, or I would give it to you. You will not be pleased with a burnt offering. The sacrifices of God, the ones that he actually does want, are a broken spirit, a contrite and crushed heart. O God, you will not despise those, but you will the others. Psalm 51 is attributed to King David of Israel after his infamous acts of murder and adultery. David is in, and I want you to notice this after what we just read, David is in a remorseful and repentant, right, contrite, crushed attitude before God. He wonders how he could possibly make things right after what he has done between him and God in their relationship. What, and this is what he's asking, what can be effective? Sacrifices? I would do it. An offering? I would give an offering, a big offering. But the answer is not sacrifices. It is not any burnt offering, because David claims God doesn't want them, even though it seems to be the natural religious response to atone for your sin. Natural, according to the heathen religious world. But Moses and Aaron, especially in the books of Exodus to Deuteronomy, say the exact opposite. They claim that God did want sacrifices. So which is it? Again, note that David doesn't believe that God is disinterested in the wrong type of sacrifice, or that he used to delight in burnt offerings, but he doesn't any longer. So God could never have delighted in sacrifices in the first place if he rejects them in exactly the sort of circumstance where sacrifices would have been presented to atone for David's extraordinary sin. If not now, when were sacrifices? When would an offering be appropriate? If not from the pure heart of a repentant sinner? Proverbs 21, verse 3. To do righteousness and justice. Righteousness and justice are not religious actions. Righteousness and justice is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. So according to the author of this proverb, God is more interested in how you treat other people, and especially how fair and honest you are, and how you stand up for and defend those who are misused, than even the most basic, the most central religious rites. Let's look at Isaiah chapter 1, verses 11 to 16. This is God speaking through Isaiah. What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices? Says the Lord, I have had enough of your burnt offerings, of rams and the fat of well-fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. Notice this. When you come to appear before me with the blood of bulls, goats, and lambs, with your sacrifices, presenting your offerings to burn at the altar, when you come to appear before me, who has required of you this trampling of my courts? Who asked you to come and do this? Clearly God didn't. Bring no more worthless offerings. I don't want them. Your incense is repulsive to me. Your new moons, not God's new moons, your new moons that you made up, your appointed feasts, not God's, my soul hates these things. They have become a burden to me. And he tells us why he hates them a little later. But he says, they have become a burden to me. I am weary of putting up with them. So God, speaking through his prophet Isaiah, says that offerings are vain, pointless, empty, meaningless, ineffective, can't do the job that you think they're supposed to do. And it's not that the Jews are performing offerings incorrectly, but offerings as a religious activity are never were of any interest to God. And then God says that their new moons and their feasts used to be tolerated, but now they have become a burden. And that's interesting because it would suggest that God never really liked them. But if Israel, who designed the days of celebration and sacrifices and liturgy, if they used those occasions to honor God, then he could at least bear them. But now, since they've become devoid of any worshipful value, then God can't stand them any longer. The minor prophet Amos in chapter 5, verses 21 to 24 says, I despise your feasts, and I take no delight in any of your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and your grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the peace offerings of your fattened animals, I will turn away and I will not even look at them. Take away from me the noise of your songs to the melody of your harps. I will not listen. Instead of what? Well, instead of coming with this religious ritualistic offerings, instead of rites and rules and observances and days, do this and I will be pleased, says God. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. That's the second time that those exact same words, righteousness and justice, are used. It's not that we have good sacrifices and bad sacrifices. It's not that the Jews were given the proper way or the proper mindset or the proper heart in which God will accept sacrifices. These passages all say he's not interested, never was, in any of it. He didn't design it. They're not his. They borrowed them from the heathen polytheistic world around them. God's saying here, I will tell you what I want. It's not a mystery. I don't want sacrifices and justice and righteousness. He says, take away the noise of your worship services. Take away, don't offer me burnt offerings. Give me justice that is freely flowing, that is quick and instant and immediate and without respecter of persons, and bring me righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. God, speaking through Amos, is saying, if you want to perform acts of worship, do not bother with pointless ritualistic religion. Specifically, the offerings and worship that Moses and Aaron claimed was handed down from God. It is precisely the types of rituals and offerings and sacrifices that they're doing because they read it in earlier parts of the Bible. That's the stuff God is saying, I don't want that. Take it away from me. I don't delight in it. And I didn't ask you to do it. Who asked you to bring this to me and trample my courts with this? Again, God is saying that the only thing that is really important is how we love him by how we treat other people. It just seems impossible, doesn't it? That even in the Old Testament, that was the message. The prophets seem to be saying that as long as you have taken a stand for justice and righteousness, then your rites, your rituals, and even your religion may potentially have some value. But if you leave the altar and worship alone, as you should, if you haven't learned to treat people with love, grace, and justice, then you'll have this figured out. Walk away from the altar. Don't bother with any rituals if you haven't learned to treat people with love, grace, and justice. Hosea 6, verse 6 says, for I desire steadfast love and not sacrifices. I desire the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. God, speaking through Hosea here, doesn't say that he likes sacrifice, but he loves steadfast love even more. He simply says, I do not want sacrifices or offerings. Micah 6, verse 6 to 8. Micah is saying, with what will I come before the Lord and bow myself to the God on high? How do you approach the great spirit, the great divine being, the eternal most high God? How do you come to that God as a sinner, as an imperfect human being? Will I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves in their prime at a year old, the best of the flock? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams? What about 10,000s of rivers of oil? Should I give even my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body, to cover the sin of my soul? The ridiculous and rhetorical question, obviously, here is how much is enough? If a small sacrifice is good, then a huge sacrifice, giving the ultimate, your own son or your own daughter, then that should be that much better, right? That's how a religious mind would work. That's how a heathen mind would work. But the amount doesn't matter to God because Micah knows that the correct answer is none of the above. He has told you, says Micah, he has told you what he wants. He has told you, O man, what is good. What is good? Which of those sacrifices would God want? Which of those would he have designed to cover the sin of your soul? He has told you what is good and what he requires of you. That is, any guesses? To do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. That's not what the Old Testament says in Exodus to Deuteronomy. It never talks about kindness in what's called the books of Moses, even though we know Moses didn't write those books. Those books talk a little bit about justice. There's a few, some of the laws are meant to try to settle disputes justly. It doesn't talk about humility much in those books. And yet here we have the later minor prophets specifically and repeatedly stating that we know he has told you what he wants. And he told you what he doesn't want. Over and over and over we see that God doesn't want offerings and sacrifices or ritualistic religion, including days, including what you eat. What he does want is for you to love kindness, to do justice, and to walk humbly with your God. In the New Testament, the author of Matthew's Gospel reiterates the same point in Matthew 9:13. This is Jesus being quoted here. Go and learn what this means. Because you don't know what this means, he's saying to the Jewish people. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and I don't desire sacrifice. I don't want it. You invented it. You created this religious framework, this structure, in order to worship me. And I tolerated it, says God, for a while. I could bear it because you devoted it to me. And you used it to honor me. But you've long since left that behind. And he explains how in a moment here. But he says, I never wanted that. I've always desired mercy more than sacrifice. And this is Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, that's the Gospel's author's point. That there's always been a choice. Do you want to be religious or do you want to be someone who loves righteousness and justice? If you can do both of those, go for it. But if you can't, if you have to choose, then leave the altar alone. Leave the feast days, leave the new moons, leave the sacrifices and the offerings and the altar and the blood and leave it all behind. And if you have to do just one thing, be just. Be righteous. God is saying that he does not desire, does not value, does not want sacrifice because sacrifices give people a false sense of righteousness. And it always did. They're doing their religious duty so well, so perfectly. But that suggests that God never wanted sacrifices. Once again, because mercy and righteousness and humility have always been of more value to God than sacrifices. Hebrews 10:4-6. For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. And it always was. So it makes no sense that it was God who told people, Israel and Judah specifically, to do something which he always knew was useless. And for 1,200 to 1,500 years, the Jews are following these rules of God that God knows are useless, that he doesn't want. Why would that makes absolutely no sense. Consequently, says the author of Hebrews, when Christ came into the world, he specifically said, sacrifices and offerings you have not desired. It's not just that he doesn't desire them now because we're in a new covenant. He said, you did not desire them. They weren't from you. In burnt offerings and sin offerings, you have taken no pleasure, even from those that did it right, at the right time, in the right manner, with the best of the livestock. So whose law was it that prescribed these sacrifices and offerings? In fact, the whole framework of the Jewish religion. Who came up with this if it wasn't what God wanted? Well, if we take a closer look at the religion of Israel, we find that perhaps many of the rites and rituals were man-made and had very little or no spiritual significance, but they served only to make people feel like they were closer to God, which all religions try to do. When we talk about rites and rituals, what are we talking about? Well, a rite is like the subject heading. It is like the headline. For example, baptism is a rite, and the rituals are the things you do in a rite. So in the case of baptism, it would be the laying on of hands. That's a ritual. The praying for God to give this person his spirit is a ritual, but the rite is baptism. Attending a church service or conducting a church service is a rite. The rituals would be the singing of the hymns, the message, the sitting in the same seat week after week after week, the having a coffee, because I always have a coffee. That's a ritual. Rites and rituals are meant to provide a framework for expressing our faith more deeply. And while they have the potential to assist in our worship and growth, they almost always end up replacing true spirituality because rituals become habits. And habits happen because we're not acting intentionally. And it's what you do when you're following, not thinking. Mark 7, verses 1 to 8, the Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw that some of his disciples were eating food that with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed ritualistically. So the Pharisees and the teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't you stop your disciples from defiling our law? Why are they not living in accordance to the traditions of the elders instead of eating food with defiled hands?" And he replied, "You know, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, hypocrites. As it is written, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain with sacrifices, with offerings, with new moons, with feast days, solemn assemblies. Their teachings, however, are actually merely human rules. Which people honor me with their lips? Jews? No, this has nothing to do with Judaism directly. It has everything to do with religion that puts up boundaries to protect the institution while judging and condemning those, almost everyone else, who doesn't meet their expectations. But in these human traditions that have replaced the true worship of me, says God, if God says what I want is justice and righteousness and mercy and humility, and the other side are human rules, then we have to include the observance of sacrifices and offerings as part of human tradition. Because we've already seen that God said he didn't want them. And there's many other passages that reinforce that point. We've also seen repeatedly that the actual commands of God are to be merciful, to care about justice, to defend the poor, the underpowered, and the needy, and to be righteous and humble, and that is clarified and enlarged upon repeatedly by the teachings of people like Jesus and the Apostle Paul, who said in Galatians 5, verse 14, the entire law is fulfilled in keeping one command. The entire law always was fulfilled if you kept one command: love your neighbor as yourself. That can't be right to our religious minds. That can't be enough. We need more than that. But what part of us needs more than that? Sacrifices, offerings, incense, altars, temples, holy days are all part of religious liturgy designed by people to serve God on behalf of the people, and done with a pure heart and done in sincerity. These things are things that aid us, and God can tolerate them and bear them. The word liturgy comes from the Greek words lit, meaning people, and ergon or ergos, meaning work. Liturgos can also mean minister. Both mean to do the work of the people. It is what church authorities do on behalf of the congregation, for God, or for the congregation to God, rather. In ancient times, the word liturgy referred to a group of people that we might today call patrons, wealthy people who gave large offerings to the Greek or Roman state in order to serve the needs of the mass of the regular majority poor people. The poor people couldn't contribute much in taxes, and it was expected by the wealthy, because there wasn't much in between. The wealthy were the 0.001% in that world, and they were expected to give large public donations to cover the needs of the poor. And in both the political and religious sense, liturgy is what someone who is able does for those who are not able. And the obvious flaw here is that in our relationship with God, Jesus was identified as the true priest and mediator. And so we have no need of another benefactor or patron or religious authority to bring us into God's presence and favor. So what should replace religion? If we throw religion out, what are we left with? Well, hopefully we should know the answer to that question. But in terms of connecting and deepening our spiritual connection to God, is there anything that can aid us in that process if religion often leads us to a dead end? Well, I don't have time for an exhaustive list, but here are a few non-religious suggestions. The first one is oneness, prayer, and meditation. So often our prayers are about a list of the things we need and plea for and demand and insist that God please bring to our life. But that's not the kind of prayer I'm talking about here. It's not the pleading, it's not the complaining, the demanding or begging meditation and prayer, but meditation and prayer to bring silence and peace and a oneness of our spirit and our purpose for life with the Spirit of God. Secondly, music and poetry can align our sense of rhythm and stability, drawing our minds away from our constant struggles, our wants, and our insufficiencies. Third is good works, or you might say being Christ-like. We fully understand the forgiveness available to us only when we quickly forgive those who trespass against us. We more fully understand grace when we are gracious. We are more at peace when we are ourselves peacemakers. We understand the service of Christ to us fully only when we serve others selflessly and with no immediate reward, just as He gave Himself for us. Through contemplation and experience in the creation, we can see the beauty inside all others, and the natural world around us fills us with awe and wonder. Thus, we live lives less in fear and more in gratitude and appreciation. And finally, fellowship. When we lose our ego and enjoy the presence of humility, we have nothing to prove, nothing to win over others, and nothing to hide. Thus, we are free to love and to give of ourselves to others. I'll close with this verse. When you ask what replaces religious rites, rituals, rules, and doctrines, what is most important to God? We've seen the answer from the Old Testament, James 1:27. Religion that God, our Father, accepts. And I would think it's reasonable to assume that he rejects the other kind, that he doesn't accept it, he's not interested in it. The kind that he accepts is really good songs, is making sure you have communion once a week. No. The kind that he accepts as pure and without fault is to look after orphans and widows in their distress and anyone else in distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the values of the world, including religious values, including religious pollution. Yes, I am, as I'm sure you are, inspired and awed by great religious architecture and pageantry and ceremony. Yes, I am inspired by the Vatican and Westminster Cathedral and the great works of sacred music and art, but those appeal mostly to the emotional part of me. Yes, I like actually the formal structure of rules and regulations as a means to evaluate my righteousness, but these appeal mostly to my intellectual self. Through the message of Jesus the Christ, we're offered an alternative, a better way, a more effective path, because that's been the question all through the scriptures. What do you desire, O Lord? What do you want from me? Jesus tells us of a more direct path that needs nothing more than placing our trust in God through his Son Jesus to transform us into the ways of justice and righteousness and searching out those with whom we can transform, so that our transformation is from the inside out, not from the religious formula of outside in.